We are working through the book of 1 Kings. Starting where we left off last week, we finished the books of Samuel, and we are preparing to move on with our study of the monarchy in Israel, following David's reign and beginning with Solomon's, then moving into a divided kingdom. That's just a quick overview. Let's talk about the title of 1 Kings. As with 1 and 2 Samuel, these two, 1 and 2 Kings, were originally combined into one book, one very lengthy book, as I found out when I attempted to read all 60-some chapters this last week. It's a very difficult task to achieve. And you can imagine that when they were all one unit, that scroll written on sheepskin, which is significantly thicker than paper, would have been quite a bit heavier, quite a bit bulkier than most people would have wanted to carry around. So the division here is not necessarily a comment as to the importance of any particular king or the order in the book. It's just more done for convenience's sake than any other reason. The name Kings comes from the first word in the Hebrew text, which is kings. When combined with 1 and 2 Samuel, another set of books that was divided, it is the third part of a series recording the events of the Jewish monarchy, both for Israel and Judah. For this reason, some, especially those in the eastern part of the church, the Catholic Church, will call it Third Kingdoms or the Third Book of Kingdoms. So, depending on where you are, the title for this book is 1 Kings or 3 Kingdoms. A good subtitle for it is, however, The Divided Kingdom. And the reason for that is, as you read through these two books combined, you will find that it transitions from the kingdom that God built on David, his servant that had a heart that was after God, sought after God, and it transitions into Solomon, who started out well, but didn't finish so great. And then his son, who didn't even really have a good start at all. So within three generations, the kingdom was divided. And a good summary statement for the book would be that God allows the united kingdom of Israel to divide because Solomon failed to follow David's example as a man after God's own heart. So God allowed the united kingdom of Israel, united under David and Solomon, to divide because Solomon, at the end of his life, failed to obey the commands that God had given David in the Davidic covenant, which we will look at again later tonight, and continued to maintain his purity and his desire to follow God. What about the author? Like with 1 and 2 Samuel, there were several writers, several sources involved in 1 and 2 Kings as you read through these books. First is the book of the Acts of Solomon. That corresponds roughly to the book of the Acts of David that we discussed for 1 and 2 Samuel. These were probably written by prophets, especially if you think that the book of the Acts of David was written by prophets, Gad, Nathan, and the other prophet, his name just slipped my mind, who came to David and worked with him. It would make sense then that the book of the Acts of Solomon would have been written by prophets, but then after the kings divided, the chroniclers of the courts would have kept the record, the official record, if you will, of what happened during each king's individual reign. So you have the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah and the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. And both were cited, both were used in the construction, the writing of this book. These courtroom historians recorded the historical events of the reigns of the kings, but, as I mentioned, it's most likely that the prophets also participated in the writing. And the reason, there are several reasons for that. One would be that the prophets were recognized by many as God's chosen speakers. By the people who believed in God, they recognized that God was speaking through them. So when they recorded what God wanted them to say, it was obvious to all who received it that it was coming from God and that they had been empowered by God to write that. 2 Kings, as a matter of fact, 2 Kings 18 through 20, most likely comes directly from Isaiah 36 through 39. These chapters are very similar in content and in verbiage. So we know that Isaiah was a prophet. He was the prophet that God used to speak to the king Hezekiah during his reign. That's recorded in those times. 2 Kings 20, verse 1 says, "In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death. And the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz, came to him and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live." So Isaiah was a prophet that spoke to the kings of Judah. And when you find a large portion of this historical record that is almost taken directly from Isaiah's own writing, it makes sense then to think that the prophets were involved. Another example is in the book of 1 Kings, you have the prophet Elijah. And it's hard to imagine that a prophet as important or as well known as Elijah would not have had some influence in writing down what he saw around him. Someone who faced off with the prophets of Baal, faced off with Ahab and Jezebel, was in a very good position to record the judgments that God was giving to the land as a result of their sin. But he also the record of the Shunammite woman, where Elijah told the woman to make him a cake before she cooked for her and her son. And when she did that, she had food for the remainder of the famine. That is an event that probably, you know, spread a little bit, especially in the area, but I wouldn't imagine that the biggest, you know, the most intricate details would have been well known just to the whole region around. So events like that indicate that the prophets were probably involved in the writing of these books. But also like 1 and 2 Kings was probably compiled by a later writer. As you read through the book, many verses will say, "unto this day," kind of like they did in 1 and 2 Samuel. I've listed some of them up there, 9:13, 9:21, 10:12. There are others. These suggest that at a later point in history, another writer came along, looked at the records that were left by these chroniclers in the kingdom of Israel, the kingdom of Judah, the ones who had recorded the Acts of Solomon, then even the prophets, compiled all of that together. And it also suggests that most of the book was compiled before the exile. Because if these descriptions of how the land was divided are unto this day, then it means that the land hadn't been messed up yet. And the invaders had not yet redistributed people. The destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar must have been recorded after the siege was completed, obviously, for the full events to be known. Now, that's in the last chapter of 2 Kings. So, most of the writing probably took place at the beginning, right before the destruction by Nebuchadnezzar, but part of it, the very end, would have happened, been written after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. My suggestion for an author is that it was possibly Jeremiah. There is not a specific author recorded anywhere in the Bible, and there's not a verse that says this person was involved, but there are a few clues that suggest it might have been him. One of them is that this important prophet's name is completely missing from the books. Isaiah is mentioned several times, Elijah, Elisha, but Jeremiah, who wrote several books in the Old Testament, is completely left out. And to leave out a character of such importance doesn't make a lot of sense, except maybe if it were done from authorial modesty, not wanting to mention himself in the books. So, one reason to suggest that it might have possibly been Jeremiah writing these books of 1 and 2 Kings. The date? Well, if it was Jeremiah, then you have to place it towards the end of the kingdom years of Israel. 1 Kings records the kingdom period from the end of David's reign until Ahab's death, roughly 125 years of history, from 971 BC until 845 BC. If 1 and 2 Kings were both compiled by Jeremiah, they would have been written around 561 BC when Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and destroyed the city. So what about the actual events in the book? Who are the key people? Well, there are several key people in this book of 1 Kings, and really it's kind of difficult to boil it down to this list because you have so many kings that just keep coming up and coming up. But you start with David. And David is a transitional character between both 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. He ties both of these books together as he is delegating his role as king to the next main character, Solomon. When you start reading the book of 1 Kings, actually both of these men are still living. David is alive and instructing his son Solomon, who he has brought up and actually crowned king, giving him advice about how to deal with particular people that he had problems with during his reign. And Solomon then takes that advice, works with it at the beginning of the book after David dies, completes what David recommended for him to do, actually, and then moves on to the rest of his reign, which was one of the most profitable ones in Israel's history. If David was well known, Solomon was much more famous throughout the whole world due to his wisdom. His son, Rehoboam, and then Jeroboam, the two kings that split off into Judah and Israel, making it two kingdoms. Elijah, the famous prophet who confronted the prophets of Baal in a very miraculous event on top of Mount Carmel, where the prophets cried out to their god Baal for hours, trying to get him to send them fire unsuccessfully. And Elijah doused the altar, the sacrifice, the ground around it in water, and then prayed a simple prayer. And God sent fire, destroyed the altar, consumed the sacrifice. And in Elijah's time as prophet and probably writer, we have the characters of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, these two were joint rulers, king and queen. Ahab was king. Jezebel was the queen of Israel during Elijah's time. They were the two monarchs responsible for the Baal worship becoming the primary religion in the northern kingdom of Israel. So they're very wicked people, and their actions were judged by God for a long time to come. Baal worship. We mentioned Baal worship, and I think it's important to discuss it just a little bit. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail. This is something that I have been doing a little bit more research on in preparation for my trip to Asia here, where I'm going to be teaching about idolatry. And it started, as a matter of fact, way back with Solomon. How did Solomon introduce Baal worship? Well, Solomon had a weakness for the women all around him, and he had something like 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's a lot of women in the house. And he had, with these women, at the end of his reign, they started to pressure him into worshiping the false gods that they had come out of. So when he took wives from the lands all around him, they brought their gods, and he built their gods' houses for their wives to worship in. And at the end there of his reign, 1 Kings 11:4, it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his sin was the first step in Israel's downhill spiral after the kings began to reign. Then later, future kings made idolatry even more important to the people. Jeroboam, pretty much as soon as he became king of the northern half of the nation, the northern half, Israel, decided that it was too challenging to his authority to have his kingdom go back down to Israel to worship God. To rectify the situation, he had very similar action to Aaron in the book of Exodus, I think it was, where he made the golden calf, two golden calves, to replace the worship that was supposed to center at Jerusalem. Now, when he did this, it wasn't, he again proclaimed, like Aaron, that this was to the Lord, using Yahweh. And these were supposed to be visual representations of who Yahweh was. But by doing this, he brought in a foot in the door for idolatry. He had built an idol, even though it was supposed to represent God. God had commanded them that they shouldn't build idols in the Ten Commandments. And when he did this, he opened the door then for the rest of these foreign idols as well to come into the worship in the northern and the southern kingdoms. Ahab and Jezebel then, by the end of their reigns, were already systematically seeking out and killing the prophets of Yahweh, trying to destroy them because they hated Yahweh worship. They did not like the prophets because they told them things that they didn't want to hear. And these two rulers tried to get rid of them. But who was Baal? Baal was the head of the Phoenician pantheon, who was associated with the monarchy, the sea, hunting, colonization, even the resurrection in some ceremonies. In some ways, his worship was very similar to that of the Ammonite Moabite Molech, or Chemosh Melech, and could occasionally require human sacrifices if the situation was dire enough. Now, where does that remind you of? Back in the earlier parts of Israel's history, when they were coming into the land, and the judges were trying to drive out the foreigners that came in and brought their idol worship with them, the judge that told the people, your God will allow you to possess the land, the judge that said the Moabites would possess what their god Molech allowed them to possess, this is probably the same God. They have a lot of the same characteristics in their worship. Baal was closely associated with Ashtoreth, the goddess of the earth and fertility, whose worship involved ritual prostitution as sympathetic magic. So sympathetic magic is the idea that one can perform an action himself and thereby influence the gods to do the same action on his own behalf. By participating then in this fertility ritual, they were hoping that their god, Ashtoreth and Baal, would give them profitable crops, give them good harvests, so that they could continue on with life. Together, their worship was performed by a conclave of priests that were either part of the royal family or had a close relationship to the Phoenician royalty. So that's why you see such a close relationship in the Old Testament between the prophets of Baal and the monarchy. They were very closely tied, as a matter of fact, even back to the Phoenician kingdom, where it suggested that the king of Tyre and Sidon became like the head of their gods. He was a god to them. Baal worship became the sin that plagued both Israel and Judah for a long time. I think that's enough about Baal worship. There's a fine line to be drawn between going into too much detail, especially when there's something as corrupt and pagan as Baal worship, and what you need to know to understand the events of the book. What about the background of 1 Kings? The power struggle at the beginning of 1 Kings was initiated by David's sin with Bathsheba in 2 Samuel. And I say that because as you read from 2 Samuel into 1 Kings, David's sin brought in a new wife, Bathsheba, who he quietly promised would have the son that would then be the king. But when he didn't make that promise known to everybody else, as he was nearing the end of his life, who's going to fill the void? And another of David's sons stepped up, tried to fill the void, and got all the princes and everybody to concur with him, except for this little group that knew that Solomon was supposed to be the king. And as David heard about this, he decided to formally instate Solomon, his son, as the next king in his stead. It is also important to note that King Solomon's initial successes as king came from King David's dedication to serving God. David was a man after God's own heart. That was the characteristic that really defined him throughout his entire reign, apart from those instances where he failed for a time and then quickly got back into the will of God. So when David served God, God blessed him and allowed him to become a powerful ruler. But he also allowed David to get victory over most of Israel's enemies in the surrounding region. That made Solomon have a peaceful reign. It allowed Solomon to dedicate much of his time, a lot of the necessary resources, to building the temple, this wonder of the world. The book of 1 Kings is set throughout the entire nation of Israel. Really, it follows the united Israel under Solomon, focusing on Jerusalem and Judah in the center. That's at the beginning. But after the division from north to south, 1 and 2 Kings alternate to describe the events of each king's reign. Both books are set in the entirety of the Promised Land. Really couldn't go through and describe each individual setting in such a brief class period. It would take a long time to do so. A key word looking through the book of 1 Kings is division. After a short period of unification, Israel is split into two kingdoms. And the split occurred in 1 Kings 12, 1 through 11. So I'd actually like to have us go ahead and look there in our Bibles, 1 Kings 12, 1 through 11, because I'm going to draw a short application from this as we proceed. 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. First Kings chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass, when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father and his heavy yoke which he put on us lighter, and we will serve thee. So at the beginning, right after Solomon's death, this man Rehoboam is placed in a position where he could be the king of both united Israel and Judah. And King Rehoboam consulted, I skipped the verse 5. And he, Rehoboam, said unto them, Depart yet for 3 days, and then come again to me. And the people departed. And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, How do you advise that I may answer this people? And they spake unto him, saying, If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever. But he forsook the counsel of the old men, which they had given him, and consulted with the young men that were grown up with him, and which stood before him. And he said unto them, What counsel give ye that we may answer this people, who have spoken to me, saying, Make the yoke which thy father did put upon us lighter? And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, Thou shalt speak unto this people that spake unto thee, saying, Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us. Thou shalt say unto them, My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. Now whereas my father did lade you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. So, what is the lesson to be learned from this little exchange? The older counselors that Rehoboam went to, was it Jeroboam or Rehoboam? I have it up there, but I think I read something wrong. Yeah, Rehoboam. I have it wrong on the slide there. The people promised to obey Rehoboam's rule if he lightened the tax load that his father had put on them. The older counselors then, when he came to them, and discussed it with them, said, What should I do? I need some advice. They said, Do what they want. Lighten your load. They will then serve you because they recognize that you're speaking kind to them. You're doing good things for them. But as a king, who doesn't want to be greater than the king before you? That's from what I understand, a natural thing. I wouldn't know. But the older counselors did not give Rehoboam the counsel that he wanted to hear. So he turned then to his friends, the ones that had grown up with him, the ones that he had known from kids. And he asked them the same questions. And they consulted him to do the opposite, to make the load heavier. And when Rehoboam listened to the advice that he liked, he lost control of the kingdom. So, an application for us. When we listen to the advice that we know to be right, even though we are not really wanting to do it because we know that something else would make us happier, do we listen to that wrong advice? The book of Proverbs tells us to beware of flatterers because they will tell us anything in order to be our friends or to get us to do something. But the better advice will always come from those who are not trying to gain anything from you by the advice that they give. Rehoboam did not really realize, he might have realized it, but he didn't understand the impact that it was going to have for him to try to obey the counsel of his friends who wanted to get on his good side than it would be to obey the counsel of these older people who had been around a little longer and seen what would happen if he did not lighten the load. As a result, then, of Rehoboam's listening to the wrong advice from the wrong people, the kingdom split. Two tribes went with Rehoboam. The remaining 10 went with Jeroboam. A key doctrine in the book of 1 Kings is the Davidic covenant. And up there it says 2 Samuel 7, 8 through 16. That is where the Davidic covenant is introduced. So I went ahead and left that up there. These slides are pretty much the same. I just put them up to review really quick from last week. The Davidic covenant, what is it? Well, God came to David and promised a couple of things to him. And it was pretty much an unconditional promise. There was a part at the end where God promised to do something if they did not obey him. But for the most part, this promise is going to be fulfilled because God said it would, not because of something that David did. So David's name will be great. That is the first part of the promise. And this was fulfilled in his lifetime and has continued even until now. David's house would be established. The house refers to David's kingly line. And God promised here that it would be established forever. Now, this is the part where David didn't have to do anything about it. It was God promising it to him. And God promised never to take away the kingdom like he had done to Saul, even if David's descendants were to turn away from obeying him. And this is the part where God put a little bit of a condition to it. God told David that his line would be chastened if it rebelled against him. Now, if you look at Israel today, there is no king in Israel, at least sitting on a throne. But has God failed in his promise? No. The answer is no, because he is chastening Israel like he promised. So, for a time, God has removed the kingdom from Israel. He did that again when the Babylonians came and invaded Jerusalem. The next king, the king, the Messiah, the king from David's line who will reign in the future, was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. At his crucifixion, he allowed Gentiles to become God's people as well. This is the king that was foretold by the Davidic covenant, the king whose line would never be cut off because he is a righteous king, and he will never turn from following God. The doctrine of the Davidic covenant is continued in 1 Kings. God will not break his covenant with David even if his descendants sin. That's part of the unconditional part of the covenant. God promised David's line would continue until the Messiah came. And even though Solomon sinned, God mercifully allowed David's descendants to continue ruling in Judah and Bethlehem, even though the majority of the tribes followed the northern kingdom. Let's do a quick overview of the book. It starts off with the United Kingdom in chapters 1 through 11. Solomon is crowned as king over his brother, instead of his brother. I told you a little bit of this background already. At the beginning of the book, there is a transition between David and an unknown heir because David had not declared who his heir was going to be. In order to fix the confusion, David made an official proclamation that Solomon was going to be his heir, and then Solomon makes the initial steps in becoming king. A little bit thereafter, Solomon received a dream from God, a vision from God, in which God promised to give him one thing, whatever he asked for. He asked for wisdom, and he became the wisest man in the world. wiser than anyone who has ever lived, save one, which we will look at later. The temple, then, was constructed during this time because Solomon didn't have to worry about foreign threats coming in. He was getting tribute from foreign countries because everybody around recognized the might and the wealth and the prosperity of his kingdom. It allowed him to build the temple, and then after he built the temple, it allowed him to construct his own house and to pursue many other building projects. During this time, his reign climaxed, and the book of 1 Kings even goes so far as to say that silver was counted as very little worth during his reign, which just boggles my mind because I don't think any of us would say that today. And how he could make in such a wealth of a display of wealth is really an indication of how much God was blessing his kingdom and his reign while he served God. While he was faithful to the covenant, God blessed him. But then, we read the verse earlier, Solomon allowed his wives, his foreign wives, to distract his attention and to take him into serving other gods. And there you see the beginning of the decline of the United Kingdom. After Solomon's death, the divided kingdom, chapters 12 and on. It continues all the way into 2 Kings. And at the very beginning of the divided kingdom, you see idolatry entering with both Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Golden calf worship was reinstated in the northern kingdom. And for the remainder of the books, 1 and 2 Kings, you have a summary of the kings of Judah and Israel kind of alternating between them, tells what's happening in each country, tells when each king began to reign in relationship to the next. And it winds up with a rather long historical account of Omri's wicked dynasty. Omri was a ancestor of Ahab. And you have the entering of Baal worship into Israel. You have Elijah's opposition of Baal, his confrontation of the prophets on Mount Carmel. And it ends off then with Ahab's death in response to as God's judgment for failing to lead his people properly. And really, that, like I said earlier, that's kind of an arbitrary place to split the books. It was done for convenience sake rather than any real reason of order or anything like that. It's approximately in the middle, would allow for two similar sized scrolls instead of one really bulky, awkward one. What about Christ in 1 Kings? I mentioned that Solomon was the wisest man in the world, save one. And God gave Solomon more wisdom than any other person in the world had ever had, ever dreamed of having. And as a result of this wisdom, people came from all over to meet him, to talk to him, to hear his wisdom. But Christ is greater than Solomon because he is all wisdom, because he is God. When the Israelites rejected Christ and his wisdom, they made their condemnation worse than those who came to see Solomon. I have this verse in there, Matthew 12:42. You don't have to read it or turn there, but I will just to read it really quick. Matthew 12:42. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. So even though Christ was greater than Solomon, had more wisdom, the Jews who were claiming to look for the Messiah missed it. Somehow they decided that his wisdom wasn't really wisdom and they turned and rejected him. But even the queen of the south, the queen of Sheba, came up all that way, made a trip just to see Solomon to hear his wisdom. Christ is, in a way, the fulfillment of the wisdom that he gave a token amount to Solomon back in the Kings. Now, we've kind of left this section out for a little while because there really haven't been many challenges to the books. But there is one challenge in the book 1 Kings and even in 2 Kings. It kind of goes with both of them, so I'm going to address it here. And that is, why don't the lengths of the king's reigns match up? Someone along the way figured out that if you add up all the years that each king reigned, that the books say that each king reigned, there are more years accounted for than there actually were years between David and the fall of Jerusalem. So how do you fit that in? Well, frequently, as in the case of David and Solomon in 1 Kings 1 and 2, a currently reigning king would crown his successor and bring him in as the king even before he had died. In the times when they did this, both kings' reigns were counted for even during that overlap of time. So David reigned for 40 years, but even though Solomon was reigning for the last little bit of time before David died, David's reign was still counted as continuing. So if you do that overlap, it really gets rid of a lot of the challenges. But another of the challenges is also that they switched calendars several times during these books. And the Northern Kingdom used one type of calendar where they did count the beginning of a year as part of the king's reign, and the Southern Kingdom used a calendar where the end of a year where the king reigned and the beginning of the last year of the king's reign didn't count. And it was a bit confusing going between the two, but yet the Bible is still accurate, even though it might not look like it is on first glance, because these were widely accepted practices that we didn't necessarily realize when that initial challenge was drawn up. The kings reigned together, and if you refigure the math with that in mind, it does make a lot more sense. As we close tonight, I'd like to go back and look at that application from the idols. Baal worship might not actually originally, in Tyre and Sidon, from some of the research I was doing, involved an idol 100% of the time. An idol is anything, though, physical or intangible, that takes God's place. Let me ask you, when you find something that you rely on more than God and more than what He has given to you to meet your needs, your emotional, your physical, whatever need it might be. Now, it might be a good need, something that God has built into you as a person, something that you really do need. When you allow something that is not God to fill that need and then worship that thing as God by worshiping it, trying to find it, trying to get it in any way you can, that thing, even if it's intangible, has become an idol. It is a counterfeit of what God has intended to be a part of your life. What counterfeit has taken God's rightful place in our lives? That's the closing question I'd like to leave you with. What counterfeit has taken God's rightful place in your life? Is there something, you know, we don't have a lot of physical bowing down to idols here in the West. It seems like something that we've kind of gotten away from as we are becoming more knowledge-based. But if you go to the Far East, where I'm going to be in a few weeks, it's all over the place. People are bowing down to idols all the time. We have our idols here, though, but they're more mental. They don't have to be a golden statue set on the street corner. What counterfeit is it that is taking God's rightful place in your life? Let's remove even those mental and spiritual idols from our lives so that we can fully dedicate our lives to serving God. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and close for tonight. As I've mentioned a couple times, I will be gone for the next several weeks. I will be teaching in Myanmar, and therefore, obviously, I won't be teaching here. The plan is for my dad to resume teaching for me when he gets back at the end of this week, and I assume he'll just pick up with 2 Kings and keep going till I get back, when I'll begin again. So thank you very much for coming tonight. At this time, we will go ahead and divide up for prayer.